transmitiendo desde San Ildefonso número 28, antigua Escuela de Jurisprudencia, proyecto grado cero de la enseñanza del derecho en México. Esto es Procrastinando, un programa de filosofía del derecho con un carácter totalmente informal.
Buenas tardes, Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México. Buenas tardes, México. Buenos días, donde sean buenos días, y buenas noches, donde sean buenas noches. Sean ustedes bienvenidos a otro programa más aquí en Proyecto Grado Cero, y seguramente que también saldrá ahora por Revista Grado Cero, por la radio del Proyecto Grado Cero. Y pues hoy tenemos un invitado de lujo, hoy sacamos la vajilla de porcelana, ¿no? Hasta se bañó Carlos Lin, imagínense, no se bañó, ya todos vienen limpiecitos, porque hoy nos acompaña el doctor Josh Letzas. No, ahorita aclaramos si bien, está bien pronunciado el nombre. Y es un distinguido académico que va a venir en un evento, y hago el comercial de una vez para los compañeros que van a hacer, va a venir en un evento que se llama Seminario Ronald Dworkin, un seminario que se va a llevar a cabo el día de mañana 11, no, pasado mañana 11, y el día del viernes 12, en un seminario que se va a hacer en dos sedes, una en el Instituto de Investigaciones Jurídicas y otra en la Suprema Corte de Justicia. Y pues tenemos el privilegio que esté aquí, gracias a mi amiga Ana, ¿no? Ana Sainz, que pudo traerlo, y de Carlos Pérez, del doctor Carlos Pérez, allá de la Suprema Corte, a quien le enviamos un cordial saludo. El doctor Letzas es un distinguido académico. Voy a permitirme leer un poco de su perfil para aquellos que no lo conocen. Es miembro de la facultad en Inglaterra. Él tiene un doctorado en Derecho desde el 2005 de la UCL, ¿no? En donde, paréntesis, su tutor, entiendo, fue Ronald Dworkin, ¿no? Ahorita vamos a platicar sobre eso. Tiene un máster en Teoría Política y Teoría Jurídica con una distinción del Departamento de Políticas, de Ciencia Política de la UCL, y también tiene un estudio de licenciatura en Derecho por la Universidad de Atenas. Ahorita él es director, codirector del Instituto para Derechos Humanos y coeditor de la UCL Queen Lecture Series in Jurisprudence, y también ha sido publicado en la Oxford University Press y ha sido publicado por otros editoriales. Tiene un libro muy interesante del que vamos a hablar ahorita, que también es sobre interpretación de los derechos humanos. Dicho esto, la plática, advierto, será en inglés. Posteriormente, una vez que hagamos la estenográfica y ya tengamos la aprobación para poderla traducir, incluiremos la traducción. Welcome, Professor Letzas.
Very nice to be here. Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks to you. First question about, first of all, welcome to Mexico. It's a pleasure to have you here. And in this important occasion, which is the Dworkin Seminar. As I told before, Ronald Dworkin was your tutor in your PhD. What is your thesis about? The first question will be, and how was working with Ronald Dworkin? How was Ronald Dworkin?
Right. So I did my dissertation under Dworkin in Delhi 2000. So I arrived in the UK from Greece, where I did my first degree, as you mentioned. And at the time, Dworkin was half of the year at UCL, half of the year in New York. He taught me during the master's, he taught legal theory. I have to say, going to London to do the master's, I was quite critical of his theory, to which I had been exposed in Athens, as I'm sure happened in many countries around the world. His ideas had traveled way beyond the US and the UK. So even in Greece, when I was doing my undergraduate degree, we knew who he was, we knew his theory. And at the time, coming from a rather formalistic and lefty culture, I thought his ideas were too liberal, too right-wing, too idealistic to be implemented. So I came to do the master's in a very critical tone. But being taught by him in these lecture theatres and being exposed to the powerful way he would put a point, the way he would argue against objections, he would win you over instantly. So within a few months, when I would read his work more thoroughly in English. I would ask him questions in class. I converted to his way of thinking. Not immediately to his way, to his ideas, but the way of arguing about law, which was very critical, argumentative. And instantly, within a few months, I thought, this is interesting. Because before going to the UK, I thought law was boring. You know, judges, all they do is either they apply rules or they apply their politics. So why would anyone want to study law? I wanted to study political theory. So I came with that frame of mind. And immediately within a few months of knowing him, knowing his work, I was converted to the idea that you can do important work as a legal academic through law, through looking at the practice of law. So then I stayed at Bishop to do my PhD. And at the time, in the UK, it was a time of change because the UK had just incorporated into domestic law the European Convention on Human Rights. It was brand new to the UK. The British lawyers didn't know much about it. It wasn't part of domestic law. And I, however, coming from Greece, was very familiar with it because Greece had already incorporated the European Convention many decades ago. And in fact, it had a higher legal status under the Greek constitution, so it would override domestic law. So I was well familiar with the jurisprudence of the international courts. So to me, that was a revolution, and everybody was talking about that. And I spoke about it with Walker. He said, well, you should do your dissertation on the European Convention. I initially wanted to do it on something really abstract, like objectivity in law and the nature of coherence. And he advised me, I think, well, at the time, you should do something more practical, something more legal, and have an impact at that level. So then I began working with him. It was a difficult time for him because his then wife was ill, and he had to travel a lot. So I would see him half of the time. But I have to say, I remember the supervision sessions to be extremely stressful and demanding because he would run a supervision session the same way he runs a seminar. You would present your ideas and he wouldn't say, it's good, it's bad, you have to improve on this is weak. He would say, oh, so why do you think that? What's the argument for thinking that? It would be very Socratic, right? He would try to get you to think more about what you're saying without necessarily guiding you in a particular way, only directly. And I remember leaving a session with him feeling lost. Feeling I had no ideas, I had no thesis, I had and then try to think more. And then it would be only months later that I would, oh, that's what he was trying to get me to see. So that was his style of supervision. Very indirect, very Socratic, very dialogic, getting you to reflect more on what you're arguing, trying to find the argument in your own views as opposed to be told the different positions, which I think was great. It benefited me a lot. And the other thing that's he was doing it at the time, and it was great, was he ran this colloquium every week in the second term where he would invite distinguished philosophers to present work in progress. And that was a three-hour session. And it was like an unbelievable high-octane workshop. I felt very privileged being part of it because you could ask a question, you could be in that close circle of the people he was working with and the people he was reading. And these 4 years doing my PhD in those conditions, I think, was of huge benefit to me. Overall, I think Dworkin was a towering figure at UCL. Like, his presence was magnetic.
Yes.
He would draw people from all over London. I have to say, this is the time when I also met two very good friends who are hosting my visit today here, Carlos and Anna, whom you mentioned. And we felt, Carlos, Anna, we felt at the time we are witnessing here a very unique phenomenon. This leading scholar being in at the peak of his intellectual work, trying out ideas. At the time, Dworkin was working on moving away from law, working more on moral philosophy.
Yes.
And on the idea that not only law, but also morality is a matter of interpretation.
Isn't it the time where he wrote the Justice in Rogues?
That's right. But he was moving towards the idea that morality itself is a matter of interpretation, which came later in the book, Justice for Hedgehogs. So we felt really, this is history happening here.
Yes.
Going back to your question, I felt very privileged being at UCL at the time. And that continued when I joined as a member of the department. So as a young lecturer, at my first year at UCL, I got to sit next to the Dworkin to co-chair the colloquium. Which I found very stressful, but on the other hand, extremely rewarding because I could see the way he was working through the ideas of other people. And I once asked him, how do you do it? Because he had this ability, enormous, impressive ability to summarize someone else's work in 10 minutes in this flawless, sharp, and deep way, often better than the speaker himself could do it. And I asked him, how do you do it? And his response was very honest. He said, look, it's a matter of practice. I wasn't always good at this. It's just by doing it, you become better and better. And you realize the more you do it, the better you will become. It's not a matter of talent, it's a matter of hard work. And this is something I want to emphasize about his work. I mean, the workshop in 2 days' time will focus on his legal theory, but it's also an opportunity to honor his memory. And many of us here are distinguished, many of the participants will be distinguished scholars in Dworkin studies. And what everyone will tell you is his work ethic was unbelievable. Like, he was working hard on a daily basis. It wasn't like ideas came to him. He was working really hard, and that's an ethic I think he passed on to his students and his friends, that what's really important is to struggle with the ideas and try to get to the heart of what people are disagreeing about, because disagreement is at the center of both law and politics. And his idea was, look, with hard work, we can resolve the disagreement, but it has to be hard work about what's at stake. And that's an ethic he had, and he displayed on a daily basis. It wasn't talent, it wasn't just being a good lawyer, because often there are many lectures of him on YouTube, online, after he passed away, and you see this amazing ability he had to speak for an hour or more with no notes. Like, he could stand in a podium and speak. But this wasn't really being a good speaker, this is being a good theorist, because he had struggled so much with the ideas to come to a view about them that he could deliver it like that. But that was a result of hard work. It wasn't a result of just being a good speaker.
In this occasion, you came here to Mexico, you will get two conferences, one about legal conventionalism, and the other one you will talk about, as far as I know, the problem of interpretation. The first question I will make you is, why is it important now to talk about legal conventionalism?
Right, so you asked me earlier about my thesis, which was about human rights, but my subsequent work is trying to combine interest in general theory of law and interest in human rights. And often what you see in today's context is the following situation. You now have more interaction between different jurisdictions and different legal orders. The world has become a smaller place, there's legal pluralism, there's courts citing each other, international law has now more of an impact in domestic law, and often these interactions are governed by strict rules. We have gone beyond the old Platonic model of having hierarchy rules of which rules take precedence, so it's more messy now. And to me, this reinforces Dworkin's idea that law is not a system of rules. Because nowadays we don't have any rules telling us which rules to enforce, and what we have now is different courts talking to each other. So how do we make sense of that? And the idea of conventions, I think, is very helpful here, because what this idea captures is the need to be mindful as a judge or as a lawyer of what other institutions are doing. And often what legal rights one has depends on what other people and other legal actors are doing in many parts of the world. And historically, this was captured by the idea of conventionalism, and this is part of what Hart, whom Dworkin criticized, touched upon. So he didn't put it like that in his original edition of the Constitution of Law, but in the postscript, he endorsed conventionalism. And then, since then, there's been an interest on the part of positivists to cash out the idea of conventions. Is law about coordination? Is it about some joint planning activity that judges and legislators are doing? So we're trying to understand why law is conventional, because clearly it has to do with collective action, to do with rules, to do with different institutions. In human rights, we have the same debate now. So you have ideas about dialogue between the judiciary and legislature, or between the judiciary and the executive. And you also have the idea of dialogue between domestic courts and international courts. How do we make sense of that? Now, my idea of making sense of that is to understand conventions in what I say is a moralized way or a normative way. The idea is not to agree between the different actors on what legal rights people have, but the idea is to be sensitive to what other people are doing, because that might be relevant to what legal rights people have. Relevant, I know, is very vague, but it could be a number of different things. One thing is fair play issues. So often what a country does have externalities for other countries. So it's unfair if a number of countries take shoulder the cost over the environment and then another country is free riding. So if you are a judge in that country, you have to be mindful of the fact that other countries are shortening their costs. And you might have to say, look, cannot free ride anymore. We have to impose a cost on our legislature because we are free riding.
Yes.
That's one example. Other example includes integrity in the legal order. So what we have now in Europe, we have the international convention and 47 member states, and we have one court. And the court in the past would be very mindful of the difference in the culture between countries. But the more there's integration of culture in Europe, the more you need the same standards of human rights to prevail. So what I've done in my own work is to be tracing the transformation of that legal order from the courts, the European courts, giving marginal appreciation to states, to gradually moving away towards the idea of coherence and consistency. Less marginal appreciation, less toleration of differences, more universal standards.
Yes.
And there I think the idea of convention can help, because the court has to be mindful of how far it should go to impose a uniform standard. And again, if you are a domestic judge, you have to be following what the international court says, and if you're an international judge, you have to be seeing what the differences are in the domestic. So these ideas of being mindful of what other actors are doing, I think is captured well by conventions and is of relevance to human rights adjudication. So I'm trying to combine these two ideas, and what I'm going to talk about in the conference in 2 days is how the idea of conventions can be given this, what I call a moralized reading. How moral principles of fairness, moral principles of human rights, can be implemented by judges. And, you know, there's an objection here, oh, says who? Judges are not elected, would they be bringing their own morality? I don't think this is a threat or an issue, because these principles are already in law. Principles of predictability, principles of human rights, of fairness, you will find them in every jurisdiction. The problem is not whether these principles are legal, they are. The problem is not formulated yet in terms of rules. So the judge has to do more hard work.
Yes.
Right, and it's this hard work that I'm now trying to emphasize. This hard work involves looking at what other people are doing, other actors, and bringing morality to bear on the issue. And I think that's the message Dawkins wanted us to preach. The message that the role of the judge is moral, he has to exercise judgment, it's not about applying rules, but this judgment must be sensitive to the conditions of his role. And these conditions necessarily involve looking at what other institutions are doing. So here's the link between human rights and conventions.
Yes. When my students saw the titles of the conference all of you will give in this Congress, they were amazed that you were talking about Bill of Rights. They said, well, what the Bill of Rights has to do with Ronald Dworkin and why he's bringing that thing here. And when I saw your curriculum, I understood why you wrote about the Bill of Rights. And I understood it better when I saw this note about the lecture you gave in November, where you criticized Lord Sompton about the way he treated the human rights.
Yes, there's always been hostility towards making rights decisionable on the part of many right-wing people. There's a fear that it would be too many rights given to criminals, to people who don't deserve to have these rights. But there's also a kind of moral opposition, you know. Rights are associated with liberal values of autonomy, toleration, and the struggle all over the world now about gay rights, about gender equality, and often, typically, these issues are fought through human rights education. But the problem, one issue now about with human rights is, at least in the UK, it's been perceived as being foreign. It's been perceived as being non-domestic. And many skeptics about human rights seize on this aspect of the European Convention in Britain to criticize it. Wrongly so, because I think the case law is very strong, is very clear, is very consistent, is very principled. So the opposition to human rights, I think, is very unfair. And what you find there is an opposition based on absence of democratic credentials on the part of the courts. And this is an old debate about whether how far judges who are unelected can go developing human rights standards, because at the end of the day, it's their judgment versus the judgment of the legislature or the executive. And this is where Dworkin comes in, because Dworkin showed, look, what you need to build on is the abstract consensus that human rights are a value of the legal system. When you have that, you move away from intentions either of the drafters or of the current majority, because that has the dangers of majoritarianism. If you interpret human rights according to what the majority thinks they are, then you deprive the human rights of the whole meaning, because they are there to protect minorities against majority. If you interpret them in the light of what the majority thinks, then it defeats the whole point.
Yes.
Likewise, with the drafted intentions. So many judges, including the UK, are uncomfortable imposing their own interpretation when the drafted intentions are unclear, or when the current majority is not sure they want to go that way. But my point, and this is what I've defended, is all you need is agreement on the abstract principle. If you have that, then the judge can fine-tune how these abstract principles apply to new cases. A good lawyer knows that. A good lawyer can,
yes.
Good lawyers can extend the rationale of the old case to the new case. And what we've been witnessing about human rights is that there are always new challenges. So take trafficking. Very few people in Europe would have thought this is a human rights issue 40 years ago. Later on, they would think it's a human rights issue, but they would think it's social rights, socioeconomic rights, not to do with civil rights. What the good people has done is say, look, this is a living instrument. Human rights are a living instrument, but not to be interpreted according to what people thought in the 50s and 60s. We have to update the meaning of human rights according to modern times. Yes. But this updating is not making new law. I don't think the court went, became activist by saying trafficking is covered by the right not to be subjected to inhuman and greater treatment. Because the principle is the same in trafficking as it is in torture. Right? We're trying to prevent abuse, we're trying to prevent exploitation. When courts take the bold step and say, look, this is a human rights issue, we're going to find this a violation, I don't see any problem of them going beyond the law. The law was already that exploitation was prohibited. So this is a point Dawkins made about the US Constitution. And what I did is I applied it to the European Convention. And I think it has helped not only lawyers think about human rights in a more expansive way, it has helped defend the court in Europe when it does so. Because the court in Europe, which is one of the most amazing things about it, has been very good developing new standards in new areas. Trafficking, prisoners' rights, one of the most controversial judgments the last few years has been the European Court finding the UK in breach of the UK for automatically and without any qualification, depriving people from the right to vote upon any conviction that comes with a sentence. So even if you are in jail for 6 months for a minor offense, during that period, you're automatically banned from voting. And the European Court said, look, this is a human rights issue under the right to vote of the convention, and what you cannot do is have an indiscriminate ban like that. You can have criteria, these criteria are up to your state, but it cannot be automatic, it cannot be indiscriminate. So what you have there, like with trafficking, like with prisoners, is vulnerable groups, groups who may not have access to political process, are being held by the international court, right? Why? Because the court is feeling confident to say, look, we can develop these principles, we can apply them to new challenges, we can help new groups previously thought they're not really human rights victims.
In 2008, you wrote a book named Legal Theory, or Theory of Legal Interpretation of the European Convention on Human Rights, in which you point that not only you get into the problem of dealing with human rights, but you say that the human rights have foundations, and these foundations are two. One is the authority of the universality of the human rights, the authority that universality gives, and the first one is that there's a state sovereignty and universality in compressing the human rights.
Pulling perhaps towards different directions.
Yes. And when I read this part of your book, I was... one of the things I say here in Mexico is that people don't understand quite well human rights, because if you go buy a book of human rights, you buy it in law section and say it shouldn't be in law, it should be in politics, not in law. But you can see that in the United States or in the United Kingdom. Here in Mexico, you buy it in law. So why is important this authority, and how that will be maybe the most important question, how do you understand sovereignty now in a global world?
Your first point is very interesting, because it points to a very interesting aspect about human rights, which is they are latecomers in political theory. So if you read the greats of the 20th century in Anglo-American political theory, Rawls, Dworkin, Raz, they didn't touch on the idea of human rights until late in their work. So Rawls published The Law of Peoples in 1993, then as an article, then as a book in the late 90s. Dworkin came to talk about human rights as different from the rights of the Constitution, again late in his career, and the same with Joseph Raz. And what these thinkers did is they reacted to a phenomenon of, in law, as you put it, in law they have become a huge thing. Like they have impact in domestic law, they are recognized in international law, they're being used by activists all over the world, they mobilize people. So it's a social phenomenon, but in political theory, it's a latecomer. And there's a question about how to deal with this. And one approach many people take is to dispute the idea that it's a latecomer and try to link human rights to the old tradition of natural rights and speak of a continuity, like we have a continuity between the 16th century until now. It's just that in the 20th century, there was a break and then we returned to the idea of natural rights. The idea there being that the rights we have in virtue of being human beings, they're given by a natural region, they're not given by the state. So the recognition doesn't depend on the state giving them to you, they depend on you having the status of a human being. And I think that's a very valid idea. I think we do well to remember it, that the right not to be tortured doesn't depend on a state recognizing that you shouldn't be tortured, right? It's to do with your dignity, it's to do with your status as a human being. But what the recent developments have shown is the need to locate human rights in an institutional context. So by sovereignty, this is what I'm trying to, you know, it can be a threat to human rights, but it can also be a help in a sense that you need to have institutions to protect human rights.
Yes.
And we don't have a global state. We don't have very many strong international institutions. We have some courts, and the European one is the most successful one at that job. But if you look elsewhere, if you look at in Asia, and you look in Africa, you don't have anything like that. So what you have to rely upon is the sovereign states. So what I think is important now is to get national states to realize that human rights are universal. And what can help here is the case law. Like all these courts, international courts and domestic courts, developing these standards, talking to each other, this dialogue, exchanging ideas, you will find, we used to emphasize the differences, now we emphasize the similarities between how different courts interpret right to life, right to not be tortured, freedom of speech. So if you look around the world, the similarities are more than differences nowadays. So what I think needs to happen is for national states to absorb the legal revolution of human rights. And I think political theories are behind. I think people have, like I mentioned earlier, political theories have been late trying to give an account of this development. But I think there's a danger, and it's this. We may appeal to dignity, we may appeal to autonomy, we may appeal to equality, as I have done in my book, as foundations of human rights. But the problem is this, these foundations will always be at the very abstract level. There's a long way to go between that foundation and justifying particular rights in law, because then many other principles come in play. Principles about institutional design, principles about distribution of resources, principles about ability of the legislature to prevent abuses. So the judgment of the lawyer, the judgment of the judge, will have to be very contextual. So what lawyers do well is to assess all those principles in a given case. Philosophers are very bad at doing this because philosophers always look for the single idea, right? If you look at books now, there's a very important book published a few years ago by Jim Griffin on human rights, and he points to one single foundation, like many others have. And he tries to see how this foundation justifies particular rights. But one common critique against his book is that this foundation overreaches. To go from that foundation to explain the difference between speech and freedom from torture, the freedom of religion, association, these rights are so different between them.
Yes.
We can say, oh, all of them at some abstract level are about dignity, and that's correct. But then you have to do the hard work of saying, okay, speech has these issues, association has these issues, and that's what lawyers can do well. So what I try to do in my book is just give examples of how, you know, we can justify particular rights. But I'm mindful of grand theories. I think the idea of trying to give one single idea as the foundation of rights is helpful at the rhetorical level. It's correct, morally speaking, but it doesn't get you all the way. What we need to do is do the hard work, fine-tuning, explaining. That's why I think it's important to write books about freedom of speech, freedom of
yes.
not so much the ethics of human rights as a whole. That would be a very ambitious book to write. There have been attempts, but I think they succeed more often than not because they stay at the general level. The minute you go down to ethical rights, then things get more messy.
Nowadays, Hasbeen publishes a lot of books. I can mention two. One, Professor Stephen Hopwood, and the other, Professor Mann from Harvard, where they claim that the human rights are coming to an end. And they claim that they are coming to an end because somehow the instrumentalization of these human rights in the legal practice has made them lose the moral content
yes.
they have. What do you think about this theory?
Well, I have some sympathy for that theory because I say in my book that one idea associated with human rights is the notion of urgency. If someone says, oh, there's a human rights violation, this claim bears with it the idea that it's an urgent claim, an important claim. It's not just any wrongdoing, it's a serious wrongdoing. It's not like breaking a promise or like failing to meet a deadline if you are the state. We're talking about serious abuse. So the notion of urgency is inherent. And then if everything becomes a human rights issue, then everything becomes urgent, which means nothing is urgent. If everything is urgent, then nothing is. So we have to be mindful of opening up the scope of human rights too much to encompass everything. And that has been a danger in the last couple of decades, particularly in many parts of the world, where activists seized on the potential of human rights to change the world, and they proliferated the claims, right? And then, of course, like the criticism you mentioned, if you make everything human rights issue, it loses its moral force. Now, what's the antidote to that? One antidote is to say human rights is finished. They offered what they had to offer, now let's move on to something else. This is what I disagree with. I think the antidote is to do the hard work of narrowing down the content of human rights and explaining what's the difference between claim human right to broadband connection. Right, there are people who might say you have a human right to have fast internet.
Yes.
Right? And a claim about human right against being trafficked, if you are a victim of trafficking. So you can proclaim rights all you want. And sometimes courts are to blame for this because they may be very liberal in what lawyers call the test of scope. So if you make an application to most courts, these two stages, one is, does this claim fall within the scope of the convention?
Yes.
Then, was there a justified interference? Was the interference justified? And often courts are very liberal for the first step. They say, okay, you know, there was this famous case in the UK of someone who had the house next to an airport. And the airport changed the flight scheme, and it went over to late nights of the day, hours of the day, so midnight. And the person complained that this interfered with his private life because he couldn't sleep at night. So this was accepted, was found admissible as an application by the European Court, who then found that the interference was justified. But initially the court examined this, and there was criticism. I discussed this in my book, that this appears to be a case of a human right to sleep well at night, or sleep. So courts sometimes encourage this, okay, come to us, we'll entertain your claim, but then we might not find a violation. But what we should take away from this practice is that at the end of the day, very few of those cases are violations.
Yes.
Because courts are no better. They then apply specific principles that they know from law, they know from precedent, and the claim gets narrowed. So I don't think the human rights have finished. On the contrary, I think now we come to realize claims like over-inclusive claims of what human rights is are not being taken seriously. What has been taken seriously is the following claim. Look for the next discovery of a vulnerable group who is a human rights victim and who haven't realized it was until recently. Domestic workers is another example, right? The European Court, again, at the forefront of looking to vulnerable groups, finding violations of civil rights against states for the way the domestic legal order allows domestic workers to be treated. So this is human rights at its best. right? Yes. Protecting the vulnerable. So I don't think humanity is over. On the contrary, I think we are at the beginning of a very serious process whereby the judiciary is doing fundamental work protecting the vulnerable and protecting the people who are, up until recently may not have had access to the political process. Because often, if a group has access to the political process, then they can change the law through elections.
Yes.
But human rights are there for the people who don't necessarily have this this access, right? Immigrants, prisoners, domestic workers. So this is what I think have actual, you know, evidence of change thanks to the human rights law. So I take these criticisms you mentioned with a pinch of salt. They are half true. They're half true that we shouldn't overinflate the concept of human rights.
Yes.
But they're wrong to think that their human rights are over.
Claiming they are. Well, two final questions, because we know you have many things to do here in Mexico. The first of them will be, what is your position, now you talk about the immigrants, about the all these kind of aspects that human rights covers, what is your position about the immigrant childs that are crossing to the United States? How can we solve this problem? Because it's a big problem. And the second question will be an easier one. What are you working next? If there is any good new book you're publishing? Or?
Your first question is really very challenging, a very difficult one. But I'll say this. I don't know the details of the situation between Mexico and the U.S. on this issue. But what I should emphasize is that these kind of problems are not problems just between two states. They are collective problems to do with global poverty and global inequalities that are sustained and reinforced by the structure of global economy and global institutions. And no one state can solve them, no two states can solve them. It needs coordinated action. And what you need to do is get enough states to agree on a solution. And then it will be very costly for those left outside to continue doing what they do. So child labor is a global justice problem. It's a problem to do with not just one country which has problems of poverty and children are just moving to another country. And the more states realize that these are global problems and no one state can solve them, the closer we'll get to the solution. So we talked a lot about human rights, and a good thing about them, another good thing about them, apart from the ones I emphasized, is pointing to the global nature of problems. And immigration is number one. It will become clear to the West that they cannot throw money at the problem of immigration. They cannot just give aid to the third world and developing economies with the hope of preventing immigration. It's going to stay a problem for the West, and the solution clearly will have to be a push towards removing inequalities globally. And to do that, you need more cooperation between states. So going back to your point about sovereignty, what we will see is, I think, retreat of sovereignty as a barrier to sharing resources. Right now, we think of social justice domestically, like what is for the Mexican society to be just, what is for the UK society to be just. We have to move more thinking about what is for the world to be just and how every country can do something about this. So we're a long way from that now. But I have to say, a lot of work now in political theory is on this problem of global justice. And there are ways to do it. Like, what you need to do is realizing and getting it to be a problem of collective action, such that every state, the US, Britain, they would be thinking, it's too costly for us to do it by ourselves.
Yes.
Therefore, we have to share the cost and transfer resources from us to other parts of the world. Well, your second question is about future work. I want to carry on working on rights, but I want to pick up on one idea which I think is global. No matter where you go in any constitutional practice in the world, perhaps the exception is the US where they have a different vocabulary, but I think in most countries of the world, when there is a Bill of Rights, you will find courts using the idea of proportionality. And if they're not using it in constitutional law, they will be using it in criminal law, they will be using it in private law and so on. So the dual proportionality is there in most legal systems, if not all. And my idea is this, can we give a notion and understanding of proportionality which is not legal? Because a lawyer can tell you, proportionality is a legal principle, the punishment must be proportional to the crime. So they would give examples of legal proportionality, but I want to take a step further and, you know, go outside the law and say, can we make sense of proportionality in our day-to-day life? What does it mean? What does it mean to be proportionate in your reaction to a friend who broke his promise or to your partner who misbehaved? And if we get a sense of what proportionality is outside the law, maybe this will help us better apply it as lawyers. So it's a typical methodology in Anglo-American theory. Study something morally and then move to law and
yes.
assess how the law is now in the light of the moral theory. So my next book will be on proportionality. So I'm now working on the moral dimension of proportionality. What does it mean for someone to act proportionately? And then I will move on to law. And right now, I mean, what I've done so far is, in the case of human rights and consumer rights, to argue that proportionality is not about balancing, because there's this idea that the desire is to balance the very different considerations and calculate the cost-benefit, do a cost-benefit analysis, like, you know, reducing this right has this cost, but it has this benefit. So my main theory is that it's not about that. It's not about cost-benefit.
Now that you took this last point, I have to make this question. You pointed out human rights and fundamental rights are the same.
Right, so in my book I argue that they are, and there's no difference between the two. And this is something I actually disagree with Dworkin, because Dworkin, after I did my PhD under his supervision, he developed this theory that human rights are narrower than constitutional rights. And the difference is this: he thought that constitutional rights are political rights you have against your government. And they include very many different rights, which if the government denies them to you, the government loses its legitimacy, in the sense that you have been denied equal standing, you are being denied equal status as a citizen. So it's an offense your government is doing against you. But that's not enough for this to justify disobedience. Because you still have to obey the laws, you're still a member of the country, of that community. But it's more a matter of you being denied the equal status in your state. Human rights are more fundamental in that sense, that if the government denies them to you, then you have the right to revolt, then you have the right to overthrow the government. That's so fundamental. And he called that idea, it's the human right to be treated with, not to be treated with contempt, right? So he thought there's a human rights violation every time the government treats you so badly that it shows contempt to your dignity. And some violations of your constitutional rights fall short of that. So they're not severe enough to be thought to be contemptuous. So if the government, he gave examples, like it's an attitude, like if the government, of course, tortures, that's like treating with contempt, treating your dignity with contempt. But if it's an issue of free speech, if it's a fine issue where people disagree about whether you can deny the Holocaust, for example, which is an issue of free speech in the US, and for him, it was a violation of free speech. But if a country like Germany, which is true, denies the right to deny the Holocaust, you don't have that legal right, he doesn't think that this is a human rights violation, because when Germany or any other country does this, that doesn't show contempt towards your dignity. So it's this fine distinction between treating someone with contempt,
yes,
and treating someone with a way that undermines dignity but not doesn't show contempt. And people have criticized this distinction. To me, it makes sense, but if you look at the practice, that's my argument against his theory, if you look at the practice of human rights, empirically speaking, like if you could look at the Inter-American Courts, if you look at the European courts, their rulings go far beyond what count as contempt. So they talk about procedures for detainment, they talk about deadlines, length of proceedings, they talk about American privilege right to vote. I don't really think that the ruling against the UK on rights to voting, like the idea that the UK denies people why they're same sentence, I don't think it shows contempt to their dignity. But it is a human rights violation, right? Yes. The European Court found a violation, right?
Okay.
So I can make sense of this idea that the distinction between severe violations where they show this extreme attitude of contempt towards people, and maybe genocide and torture and other horrible things are captured by the idea of contempt. But if you look at the practice, it's moved way beyond that, right? Very few people now would say humanity is only about those things. So even though the distinction makes sense in theory, in practice it makes very little sense, because now, legally speaking, we have gone way beyond this narrow, minimalist sense of. So that's why I disagree with him. I think human rights and personal rights are actually the same. And you see this in the degree to which they are absorbed domestically. Like in Europe, and I'm told by my friends here in Mexico, domestic courts are very open and receptive to an expansive interpretation of human rights, qua domestic rights. So they are reinterpreting their own personal rights, not as human rights. So they don't think there's a distinction. And in the same in the UK, they don't think the distinction between domestic rights and human rights. They think that human rights and personal rights are one and the same. There's the famous phrase of the House of Lords, now Supreme Court in the UK, that domestic protection of rights is to give to people no more and no less than what the European Court of Human Rights has said human rights are. Right? So to have rights as a citizen in the UK now is to have the human rights of the European Convention. No more, no less. It's the same. So I think, at least in Europe and in other parts of the world, we shouldn't distinguish between the two. Right? Theoretically speaking, I can see the distinction, but not practically.
Well, thanks a lot for coming here to the program. It has been very enlightening, this conversation. Thanks to my friend Ana, que no quiso participar, no lo digo aquí en español. Ya no voy a poner a leer derecho electoral porque ya me invitó que solo de derecho electoral hablará. Y gracias al doctor Carlos Pérez, que también gracias aquí podemos estar.
Ojalá puedan ir el día 11 y el día 12 al Instituto de Investigaciones Jurídicas. Y si más no me equivoco, el día 11 en la tarde. You give your conference at here at the Supreme Court
on Thursday.
So promete mucho las conferencias.
Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias.